I'm Laura Murphy Oates, and this is The Full Story. Living with a disability can be expensive. Getting a diagnosis, accessing treatment and care, it all costs money and requires patience. But advocates and peak disability organisations say that the disability support pension has become increasingly difficult to access, with some people making multiple attempts over many years, all while living on the poverty line. The Australian Council of Social Services says that about 36% of people receiving the lower job seeker payment are sick or have a disability. So, what is it like applying for this payment? And is this process just too hard? Today, sick, broke, and waiting for the disability support pension. It's Tuesday, the 28th of September. Hey, how are you going today, Tash? Do people call you Tash? I just automatically did it.
Tasha. Yeah, I more get Tasha purely because I come from a background in childcare. And when children are learning to speak, the Tasha, the double sound, is more. So I've ended up more with Tasha.
This is Natasha Thompson. She's 28, living in Melbourne. And one of the most important things that you need to know about her is that she's really passionate about teaching and caring for kids.
I grew up loving babies, quite passionate about that, and just really wanted to work with babies of some kind.
In 2013, she was studying to become a childcare worker and educator.
And then I also went on and did a maternity nursing qualification, which is specialised care for mother and baby for the first 4 months. It's not medical, but it is that intense care.
But just when she was about to start a teaching placement at a primary school, this confusing mix of symptoms that she had been dealing with for a while started to get worse. Things like abdominal pain.
To friends, I described my abdominal pain like white hot pokers shooting through my abdomen.
Or brain fog.
If you imagine a foggy road and you're driving and you just can't quite see through and see what's ahead of you. It's just like that, but just in everyday life, I would sort of know vaguely that I had things to do, but my brain just couldn't quite solidly grasp onto things. So I would think, okay, I have this assignment due at this time, or my class is at this time of day. And then I would all of a sudden forget. I'd know that I had a class on, but I wouldn't remember what time it was or what room it was in.
Natasha had struggled with curious and unexplained symptoms all throughout her childhood. And as she got older, health professionals would come up with various reasons as to why she was so unwell.
For most of my life, I've known that things weren't quite right.
Maybe it was just a bad period.
My periods would be intensely painful, or that's what we thought it was.
Or maybe it's just that she's too tall.
I would stand up and then feel quite faint and my vision would cloud over and I'd be really dizzy. And I've actually passed out a few times from it. But no one could figure out what was going on. At one point I was told, oh, you'll grow out of it. It's just because you're tall.
And then during her degree at university, she went through a series of diagnostic surgeries and got an answer of sorts.
So after my second diagnostic surgery, the surgeon, he came out and he said, you're not crazy. It is endometriosis. But then the pathology results came back and said, it's not technically endometriosis. It's the precursor to endometriosis. Either way, regardless of the official diagnosis, it was causing me significant pain.
Natasha was also diagnosed with PCOS, polycystic ovarian syndrome. These were the first of many diagnoses that would come years later, like Ehlers-Danlos syndrome.
The condition called Ehlers-Danlos syndrome and postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, or POTS and EDS for short, because they're a bit of a mouthful.
The constant trips to the doctor and the hospital, plus the growing list of medications and documentation she needed, was adding up financially. Plus, Natasha had to lessen her course load at university, meaning she wasn't eligible for student payments from the government. So she decided to apply for the Disability Support Pension, or DSP. And what do you need to do to qualify for the Disability Support Pension?
You need to jump through a lot of hoops.
She didn't know at the time, but this process would take more than 2 years, drag her through several legal battles, and cost her thousands of dollars.
I didn't think it would be so hard to get the support that I needed. So the way that I saw it, I guess, I was the person that needed help. This was the government system designed to help people in need, the vulnerable members of community. I expected that it may be a bit challenging, but I still didn't think that it would progress to the point where it was just also so hard.
Hello.
Hello, Luke.
Luke Enriquez-Gomes is Guardian Australia's inequality editor.
And so in recent years, the disability support pension has become increasingly difficult to obtain, and that's because of tightened eligibility and application requirements imposed by both Labor and the Coalition in the past. Mm. So there's a point system which relies on something called the impairment tables, and people need to prove using these tables that they have a permanent condition in order to get the disability support pension. You also need to show that your condition has been fully diagnosed, treated and stabilised. So that means it's been diagnosed by a doctor and you've been receiving treatment, and the doctor says that there's no more treatment that can be helpful for you, and also that there's no expectation that your condition will change over the next 2 years. At the same time, it also has to be proved that you your condition will stop you from working 15 hours a week in any job.
Mm. I mean, I imagine there are a lot of conditions that don't meet all of this criteria that you've just outlined, right?
Yeah, that's right. So in particular, different types of chronic pain can be a good example of one where it's difficult to get onto the DSP, and that's because it's hard to find a conclusive diagnosis, and if that's the case, there might be different treatments that a doctor might like to try.
Mm.
You know, if you're going through chemotherapy, for example, you know, you won't really be considered fully treated because you're undergoing the treatment. It's not this, the doctor will say, we can continue to do this and your situation might improve to the point where you might be able to work in the next 2 years. And it also, you know, it's not necessarily stabilized, right? Because it may improve, it may worsen. It's not going to be mostly static, the same for that 2 year period. Mm. So that's kind of the difficulty in that case, for example. So there's actually a Senate inquiry into the DSP happening at the moment. And that's held a series of hearings, and they've heard a lot of evidence about people being denied the DSP. But I guess it's not just that, it's also the process and the sheer amount of bureaucracy and paperwork that's involved. It's quite formidable. And you know, what the inquiry has found is that for some people, you know, there can be extraordinary wait times before they're able to get the pension.
How long are we talking for these wait times?
Well, so it's a bit complicated, but basically it's 49 days is the average wait time, which perhaps doesn't sound like that long. But within that, there are so many people who actually spend a year or 2 years waiting, and that might be because they go through some sort of appeals process, or it might be that their first claim is rejected and then they have another claim which is based on newer evidence, or their condition has stabilised and then that might be approved. So you might have two claims, one rejected, one approved, and it might not take that long to have them actually processed, but your journey getting onto the DSP can take much longer than 49 days.
Mm. And what does that mean for people in the meantime, while they're waiting for this application to be approved? I mean, what situations does it put them in?
I guess the straightforward answer to that is that they're usually on the job seeker payment, which is much less generous than the DSP, not that DSP is so generous. And the DSP is around $952.70 a fortnight. And that compares to JobSeeker, which is, you know, $620.80 a fortnight, which, you know, sometimes it's referred to by shorthand as $44 a day, and that's well below the poverty line.
So, Luke, I've been speaking to Natasha, and I know you've reported on her case in the past. She told me that when she first applied for the DSP, she was living on a $277 a week unemployment payment, which was then known as Newstart. Can you step me through how this process played out for her from there?
Well, her first assessment was about whether or not she was capable of working 15 to 20 hours a week.
Once I applied, I had a job capacity assessment, and that was held over the phone. So it was a phone call to a person. They'd never met me, never seen me in person. And we just went through aspects of daily living and how I cope. And ultimately, this person decided in their report that I was capable of working 15 to 20 hours per week with interventions, with unspecified interventions.
They said she was capable of working, and so she was denied the disability support pension, but Natasha decided to appeal. Her case then went through several layers of appeal before ending up in front of what's called the Administrative Appeals Tribunal, which is kind of like a small court, which is designed to allow people to represent themselves when they appeal, you know, things to do with Centrelink. At the first level of the tribunal, Natasha represented herself.
It was the first time that I had a face, that I saw an actual person. So every appeal up until this point was a phone call. I was just a piece of paper to these people. Whereas at this first Administrative Appeals Tribunal hearing, there was a person, and I felt like a person, and I felt like I was being heard and seen as a person. It kind of put the humanity back into the experience.
And Centrelink argued that she wasn't fully treated and stabilised.
So two out of that three criteria that you mentioned earlier to get onto the DSP.
Yeah, so one of the reasons they gave for that was that she hadn't tried all of the medications available to her.
The biggest one, I believe, that they argued was that I hadn't tried a medication called Zoladex, which to my knowledge is a medication that would essentially put me into medical menopause. At the time I was 25, 26, and I still want a family of my own. So that's it. It wasn't a reasonable treatment for me. And my medical team had agreed that it wasn't a reasonable treatment. So it wasn't really discussed because it wasn't something that was suitable.
Natasha told me that another line of argument in this tribunal hearing was that she was capable of working. Can you tell me about that?
So Natasha did charity work. She'd been volunteering at a children's hospital, and she also worked a little bit as a nanny. And the department argued that Natasha's charity work shifts were often longer than 3 hours, and that with her work as a nanny, that proved that she could sustain work activity or other tasks for periods of 3 hours or more a day. But Natasha argued that her nanny work was very flexible. It was only really possible because the family was so accommodating.
I would be able to sleep while the baby slept. I could call in sick with short notice and know that I still had my job security. And there's literally no other workplace that would accept that.
And she didn't think the fact that she did charity work should be held against her.
So I was still doing the work that I was capable of doing, but I'd also found a way to volunteer and contribute to society another way to the best of my capabilities.
So how did this hearing go?
Well, she challenged these arguments and she won. But then the government appealed that decision and it went to the second tier of the tribunal. And in that second hearing, the Department of Social Services hired a private legal team.
And it was terrifying. I was just like a person, I could barely make it through the day without a nap. And all of a sudden I'm facing this large legal firm to just fight for support to get through the day.
And came with a different argument.
Well, so that's when they challenged the diagnosis of endometriosis, which was so frustrating because initially they'd said that, okay, we accept your diagnosis. It's that you're not fully treated and stabilized. Whereas in this second hearing, they were like, cool, fully treated and stabilized. but you're not fully diagnosed. It really just felt like they were looking for reasons to deny me.
What happened at the end of your case?
So at the end of my case, I was granted the DSP.
The tribunal found that her chronic pain condition was permanent, fully treated, fully stabilised, and more likely than not, in light of the available evidence, to persist for more than 2 years.
There's still moments where I sit and shake myself like, hey, I managed to overcome this and was successful. Like, what? So there's constantly that disbelief.
Next, life on the DSP and the push for reform. How has being on the DSP changed things for you, not just financially, but throughout the rest of your life?
It's been stability. I was able to then see other specialists. And so this is how I came to have my diagnosis of POTS and EDS. And without the DSP, it's not something I could have pursued. And I did receive some back pay, which did allow me to clear some debt. And it was just a massive relief.
Even with this payment, though, Natasha is still to this day in debt.
So I have a credit card, which, I mean, still has debt even on the disability support pension, because once you're in debt, it's so hard to get rid of.
Have you heard of many stories like this where people, because of the long fight to access the DSP, do end up in debt or are put in pretty precarious financial positions?
Yeah, it certainly does happen. It might be debt, it might be withdrawing your superannuation or, you know, living on JobSeeker necessarily means that you're living in poverty, particularly for people who had maybe a higher standard of living before, who've got things like a mortgage or higher cost of living because they've got children, maybe the children have school fees, that sort of thing. If you then are unable to work and deny the disability support pension, you are almost certainly going to be living in some sort of poverty. So I listened into the Senate inquiry this month and it heard from a Sydney woman who had a nasty fall.
So good morning, Chair, Senators. My name is Cass Sutherland. On the 2nd of July 2016, life changed forever. I had a fall in my bathroom and broke my neck.
After that, she was left with no movement in her neck and she lives with chronic pain. But she told the Senate inquiry that she was rejected multiple times over a two-year period because the medical evidence wasn't sufficient and her condition was not considered to have stabilised.
The job network provider would regularly make appointments that I could not attend. I was yelled at and threatened to have my payment cancelled. I was hung up on by a supervisor who claimed it was an accident. Eventually, I attended an appointment with an assessor. She advised me that a lot of people make up stories to get on the DSP. I was shocked. Really? I chose to break my neck and live with a permanent disability?
So it took her 2 years to get onto the DSP, and in that time she withdrew a whole bunch of her superannuation and hardly has any left now.
I am grateful to be alive, but surviving instead of thriving is not a dignified life.
It seems like there are some formidable barriers for people accessing this system. You mentioned there is a Senate inquiry. I mean, is there any reform on the horizon here?
So you've got the Disability Royal Commission, which is happening at the moment, and it may well come up in that, but that's not. It's been delayed for quite a while due to COVID and won't report for a while. But at the same time, there's a review happening, which is being done by the Department of Social Services. And then there's also a Senate inquiry, which is, you know, obviously operating within the Parliament. It's those two last things that I mentioned, which are, you know, going to be most likely the main vehicles for immediate reform of the system.
Mm. Tell me about this review and this Senate inquiry in a bit more depth. What is their scope and what power do they have to enact change?
So the review is looking at those impairment tables that we talked about earlier, And it's being held because it's a decade since the whole system was reformed. And basically the legislation means that they're going to expire. The tables will expire next April or April 2022. So they need to hold a review. And it was open to submissions until July this year. And the Department of Social Services is currently looking at those submissions and then we'll start drafting the legislation next month. Essentially, advocates and you know, community members say the system, it isn't well thought out.
So basically, you have to make, I believe it's 20 points under a single table. And the problem is that people may accumulate, may often have conditions that accumulate points over multiple tables. And the crux of the issue is that someone may only meet 10 or 15 points under a single table, but accumulate 50 plus over multiple tables. And they're still, their condition still isn't considered severe because it's not a singular table.
So they've got a bunch of cups and they're like a third full in a whole bunch of them, but because you don't get one full cup, you don't qualify.
Exactly. That's a great metaphor.
So with the review process happening, definitely some advocates thought it would be a good idea to also have a Senate inquiry to sort of look at the broader problems with the system and also get some of those personal stories out, which might, I guess, create momentum for change within that impairment tables review. The Senate inquiry, it's looking at a much broader range of issues. What structural reform might be needed to the whole process.
Mm. Natasha was actually one of the authors of a submission to this Senate inquiry for the Australian Federation of Disability Organisations, which is a kind of peak body of disability organisations. And she told me that out of the many recommendations that they are pushing for in their submission, they could generally be summarised by just shifting some of this burden off of vulnerable people applying for these payments.
The essence of it is that we just want the process to be less traumatic for people, less hurdles, I guess putting the burden more on the department and less on the applicant. And I'm using the word burden because it is, because there is so much that it's a list of reports that you need, and then there's the technicalities around the language that's used, and it's just so much. My brain can't even think of any other words to describe it other than it is just a lot. And it shouldn't be so hard for the most vulnerable members of our community to access the help that they need. Like, this system is designed to help, and yet it's like the department actively looks for reasons to deny people help.
From what you've seen in your reporting, Luke, is that shift needed? I mean, is the system currently placing too much of a burden on people with disabilities to prove that they are disabled?
Yes, would be the short answer to that question. Clearly, it's a very difficult bureaucratic process. That's one issue. And the other issue is just what is the bar that they need to reach? That they need to get in order to be eligible. So we know that it can be sometimes if you make the process less onerous, that can be good or that can be bad depending on how you do it. One of the things that has happened is now there's sort of government contracted doctors that are involved and, you know, theoretically that could place less pressure on people to prove their disability, but it's not necessarily a good thing because they have less of an intimate knowledge of that person's condition than, say, their treating doctor or GP or the like. So particularly people who are really sick, right, the last thing they need to do is be trying to get all this documentation and evidence in order to just access a little bit of support.
So, Luke, I suppose there does need to be some threshold, right, to access the DSP, but it also does need to be accessible for those that are chronically ill and disabled. I mean, what would that look like, having a more of an accessible system to access the DSP?
One idea that I've certainly heard floated by Victoria Legal Aid, for example, and I'm sure other groups, is just that this idea of fully treated, diagnosed and stabilised could be changed in some way so it's not so definitive, so that it doesn't automatically exclude some people. particularly people who have a condition that is not, you know, easily diagnosed, or that it seems a bit strange to sort of mean that even if you can't work, you can only get on it if there's absolutely no chance of your situation improving. And so I understand why that rule exists, but I mean, if you can't work for an extended period of time because of your, you know, disability or because of a medical condition, it doesn't really matter if it's been diagnosed, right? It doesn't change your personal circumstances, which is that you can't work and therefore you need some support from the government. So, I mean, that sort of central test is one place that people certainly say there could be the possibility of change that would make it easier for people, for sure.
We want to work, and I don't think that's understood enough, is that I loved my job. I love and I'm passionate about what I do, or what I did, past tense, because I can't do it anymore. And I would give anything to be doing that. It's not a choice. People don't choose to be in pain 24/7. They don't choose to not be able to get out of bed. They don't choose to require naps throughout the day or be young and use mobility aids for freedom. Like, we just make the best of what we've got.
Thanks to Natasha and Luke for their time. You can find more of Luke's reporting on the disability support pension and other issues at theguardian.com. This episode was produced by Bethany Atkinson-Quinton and Karishma Luthria, who also did the sound design. Mixed by Camilla Hannon. The executive producers of Full Story are Miles Martignoni, Gabrielle Jackson, and myself, Laura Murphy-Oates. Okay, catch you tomorrow.